right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, November 17th, 2016. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everyone. It is a chilly 44 degrees and partly cloudy here in upstate New York. There's some potential for snow this weekend, yet they're saying it's going to be in the 70s on Friday. So where do we leave off this week? I've had a few things going on. Sorry I haven't been around. But we listened to an encore interview with Georgie Porgy Church on CRISPR technology yesterday, and on Monday we titled the show China, Next Gen Jobs, Election, Watson AI, and the Last Invention. And we've been looking at not only genetic technologies, but also artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, and the Internet of Everything. Well, today we are going to listen to a singularity lecture with Ray Kurzweil. Yes, our friend we love to hate, Ray Kurzweil, who is now the director of engineering at Google. And he is going to talk about something that we've talked about many times, and that is the law of accelerating returns and our accelerating future. Remember, I tell you every single time, scientists say, don't worry about it, it's going to be 100 years from now. Because of that law of accelerating returns, we're looking at maybe by 2020 or 2025, it is game over. So enjoy this lecture. This will be a 55-minute lecture for Ray Kurzweil, and I should be back live tomorrow. Everybody take care.
Great to be with you. I'm a long-time LogMeIn user, and great to see this kind of enthusiasm on this side of the country. I remember when I was starting my first companies, Route 128 in Silicon Valley were neck and neck. Silicon Valley created its own reputation. Boston's actually coming on strong. It's been strong in biotech, but now with trends like Internet of Everything, I think we see this kind of entrepreneurial enthusiasm really everywhere in the globe. And I was in China recently, and it felt very much like being in Silicon Valley. I'd like to share with you where I see Internet of Everything fitting into the overall trends in this industry. I've been tracking technology progressions for over 30 years. I realized actually in 1981 that the key to being successful as an inventor was timing. You had to be in the right place with the right idea at the right time. So the inventors and entrepreneurs whose names you recognize, like my new boss, Larry Page, actually my first boss, they were in the right place at the right time. In fact, I anticipated that. In the early 80s, I saw the ARPANET progressing exponentially, connected 1,000 scientists, and then 2,000, and then 4,000, created by the Department of Defense. I did the math and said, well, this is going to be a World Wide Web connecting hundreds of millions of people to each other and to vast knowledge resources. By the late 1990s, people thought that was ridiculous when the entire defense budget could only tie together 2,000 scientists. But that is what happened. That is the power of exponential growth. And we won't be able to find any information because there's going to be too much information on the web, so we'll need search engines. And the computational and communication resources to create a search engine will be in place by that time. Now, not everything is predictable. The fact that it will be these couple of kids in the Stanford dorm who would take over the world of search, that was not predictable. I wouldn't have to work very hard today if I had predicted that. But I do want to actually share with you what I do believe is very predictable, because I started with the common wisdom in 1981 that you cannot predict the future. But I thought, being an engineer, if I gathered enough data, if I used the right visualization tools, if I squinted at the visualization, maybe I could make some educated guesses. And I made a surprising discovery. Those of you who heard Peter's presentation yesterday will appreciate the insights that he talked about. The price, performance, and capacity of information technology, also its size, is amazingly predictable, despite the vagaries of human history. And what's predictable is that it progresses in an exponential manner. And another important observation is that's not intuitive. If you wonder why do we have a brain, it's to make predictions about the future. So when we were walking through the fields 1,000 years ago, we'd kind of look up and go, okay, that animal's going that way. I'm coming up the path this way. We're going to meet at that rock. That's maybe not a good idea. I'm going to take a different path. That became hardwired in our brains. We didn't expect that animal to speed up as it went along. We made a linear prediction of the future. That is our intuition about the future. The primary difference between myself and my critics is we're looking at the same world. We have pretty much consistent perceptions about what that means. They then just apply their linear intuition about what will happen, even unsaid. It's just so obvious that things will progress in a linear manner. For example, halfway through the genome project, 7 years into this 15-year project, 1% had been collected. So mainstream critics, including a Nobel Prize winner, said, well, I told you this wasn't going to work. Here you are, 7 years, 1%. It's going to take 700 years, just like we said. My reaction was, oh, we're at 1%. We're almost done, because 1% is only seven doublings from 100%. It had been doubling every year. There are reasons to expect that to continue. Indeed, it finished 7 years later, and every other aspect of biology has been scaling up in an exponential manner. But that's not intuitive. And as I think this audience readily appreciates, there's a profound difference between our linear intuition and the exponential reality. Not every technology progresses exponentially. It's specifically information technologies. Their price, performance, and capacity progresses in an exponential manner. And a linear progression is 1, 2, 3. An exponential progression is 1, 2, 4. Doesn't sound that different. In fact, they don't look that different at first. But by the time you get to step 30, the linear progression, that's our intuition, is at 30. The exponential progression is at a billion. At step 40, it's at a trillion. And this is not an idle speculation about the future. I mean, this little computer is several billion times more powerful per dollar than the computer I used at MIT, across the river here, when I was an undergraduate. I went to MIT because MIT was so advanced in the late 1960s that it actually had a computer, and you needed influence to get more than a few seconds of time each day. Thousands of us shared that computer. It took up a floor of a building. This is 100,000 times smaller. We have an exponential progression in size. We're shrinking both electronic and mechanical technology at a rate of 100 in 3D volume per decade, and it's several billion times more powerful. It's several thousand times more capable, several million times less expensive. There's a several billion-fold increase in price performance. We'll do both of those things again in the next 25 years. This will have computational and communication and robotic devices the size of blood cells. Then we'll really have a deeply interconnected internet of everything. It'll again be a billion times more powerful in price performance. So I'll talk somewhat about the implications of all that. These are the implications. Any questions on any of this? All right, we do have time for some questions. Think of some. I mentioned the shrinking of size. My first major invention, the print-to-speech reading machine for the blind, was, there's no podium here, but it was about the size of a large washing machine. Now it's an iPhone and Android app. We're continually shrinking technology. That's one of the enabling factors for what we call the Internet of Everything, and that we can have these tiny little connection hubs really embedded in everything. And ultimately, that's going to go inside our bodies and brains, and I'll talk more about the implications of that. So here's that graph I had in 1981. Price performance of computing. This goes through 2010, but I had it through 1980. This is calculations per second per constant dollar. And as I very often have to explain at length, it's a logarithmic scale, but I'm sure you appreciate that. Every labor level here is 100,000 times greater than the level below it. So this modest little curve, it represents trillions-fold increase in the amount of computation you can get for the same cost over the last century, going back to the 1890 American census. So some people look at this and go, "Ah, oh, Moore's Law." But you know, this progression started decades before Gordon Moore was even born. Moore's Law was not the first paradigm to bring exponential growth to computing. It was the fifth. There were shrinking vacuum tubes in the 1950s. 52, CBS predicted the election of Eisenhower, the first time the networks did that, with a vacuum tube-based computer. Actually, what they didn't show you in the movie The Imitation Game, Turing used the second paradigm, telephone relays, to crack the German Enigma code. But the Germans did catch on, so they added two more coding wheels, and then the complexity was too great for that machine. So Turing went on to actually invent the first electronic computer using vacuum tubes. It was 1,000 times more powerful. That was the third paradigm. But by 1959, they couldn't shrink the vacuum tubes anymore and keep the vacuum. And that was the end of the shrinking of vacuum tubes. But it's not the end of the exponential growth of computing. Every time we reach the end of some paradigm, it creates research pressure to create the next paradigm. And so 1960s, we used transistors, for example, in the early space flights. Then we had Moore's Law and chips. There's been regular discussions that's coming to an end. I'm constantly fighting that battle. I remember when feature sizes were 5 microns, that's 5,000 nanometers. And most engineers were confident we could get to two microns. The real optimists say, well, I think we can get to 1 micron. But nobody thought, except me, that we could actually go beyond that. There'll be thermal effects, that circuits will shrink. Okay, now we're approaching 15 nanometers, and everybody's still saying, oh, Moore's Law is going to come to an end. Actually, which it will, that particular paradigm will come to an end around 2020, but the sixth paradigm, computing in three dimensions, is already underway, and that'll keep this going for a very long time. But the most interesting thing about this, I mean, look at how predictable this is. Where's World War I or World War II or the Cold War, the Great Depression? People say, well, it must have slowed down during the recent recession. I'm sure this crowd realized that was not the case. It has a mind of its own. I have a mathematical treatment in my 2005 book, Singularity is Near, as to why this is the case, but really the empirical evidence is the most persuasive. But it's not just computing. Every type of information technology has the same progression. I was excited I could buy a transistor that could actually switch a bit of information for only a dollar, 1968. I was used to spending $50 for a telephone relay that could do the same thing much more slowly. Now you can buy 10 billion for a dollar, and they're better because electrons have less distance to travel, so they're faster. The cost of a transistor cycle, that's the measure of price performance of all of electronics, comes down by half every year. That's a 50% deflation rate. And the economists actually worry about deflation. We had massive deflation during the Great Depression, different reasons, a collapse of consumer confidence. But the concern with information technology is if I can buy the same stuff as I could a year ago for half the price, same computation, same communication same genetic sequencing, and even physical stuff. I'll talk about three-dimensional printing in a moment. I'll buy more if it only costs me half as much as a year ago, but am I going to actually double my consumption and do that year after year? After all, how much do I need? Aren't I going to saturate my ability to consume these resources? Let's say I increase my consumption 50%, which is a lot, and do that every year. Then the size of the economy, not as measured in bits, bytes, and base pairs, but as measured in dollars, will shrink. For a variety of good reasons, that would not be a good thing. But that's not what happens. I mean, here's bits of memory chip, but I have 50 other consumption charts like this of different types of information technologies. We more than double our consumption. In fact, there's 18% growth in dollars in every type of information technology each year for the last 50 years, despite the fact that you can get twice as much of it each year for the same cost. And the reason for that is what all of you are engaged in, which is invention, innovation, coming up with new applications to use these technologies, like, for example, Internet of Everything, which just wasn't feasible, you know, even a few years ago. You know, why weren't there social networks 8 or 10 years ago? Was it because Mark Zuckerberg was still in junior high school? No, the price performance wasn't there. There were attempts to do it, and then arguments, you know, can we afford to allow our users to download a picture? It just wasn't feasible. 5, 6 years ago, it became feasible and took off. I mentioned that I, you know, anticipated search engines in the late 90s, but that wasn't really feasible in the mid-90s. So there are applications just waiting in the wings. That's really why I came up with this methodology, was to time my own technology projects so I could start them maybe 3 years before they were feasible, and you know, maybe I could debug the software by the time the price performance was there. Time magazine had a cover story on my law of accelerating returns. They wanted to print my computer graph. They wanted to put a particular computer they had covered in the magazine as the last point, so it's right there on the curve. And this is a curve I laid out 30 years earlier. I had that curve from 1890 to 1980. I projected it out to 2050. We're now in 2015. We're exactly where we should be. Quite remarkably, this aspect of the future is predictable. You know, and while these little points don't look that interesting on the graph, each one is a drama. It's a new revolution. You know, one of those points is Turing's cracking the German Enigma code and then doing it again with a transistor-based computer. So he's got two of those points that enabled the Allies to conduct their Normandy invasion. Otherwise, that wouldn't have been feasible. So there's a dramatic story for each of these. Each point really makes a whole new opportunity for innovation. So communication technology, something of interest to this group, that's the number of bits we move around wirelessly in the world on the right. Over the last century, Morse code over AM radio a century ago, 4G networks today. You'd think it'd be very erratic because, you know, there's weekly headlines, multi-billion dollar telecommunication company goes bankrupt, auction of new spectrum space. It's remarkable how smooth and predictable these trajectories are. If there are only like four of us working on telecommunications and three people working on computers, it would be erratic. It's because there are millions of people involved that it's an evolutionary process. And so these kinds of smooth exponential progressions is a feature of evolutionary growth. Internet data traffic, again, each one of these points is a whole new revolution. You know, you had the ARPANET and then the Internet and then the World Wide Web. And then video, and now full immersion virtual reality is coming on, Internet of Everything. Each one of those points is a whole new opportunity for a new type of revolution. This is the graph on the left that I had in the early 80s. I had the first few points of the ARPANET, of Internet hosts, projected that out to World Wide Web in the late 90s. On the right is the same data, but on a linear scale, not a logarithmic scale. And that's how we experience it. So to the casual observer, it looked like, whoa, World Wide Web, new thing, came out of nowhere in the mid-90s, but you could see it coming. And really, this is a measure of Internet of Everything. This is the number of points of communication we have. And as that increases exponentially, you know, now it's no longer one Internet host per home, or even one per person, it's going to be one per object. Ultimately, we're going to put them in our bodies and brains, and I'll talk about that in a moment. So this is a key revolution. It actually does affect the point of this conference, but biology is becoming an information technology. Didn't used to be. It was hit or miss. It progressed linearly. That was still useful. Life expectancy was 19 1,000 years ago. It was 37, 200 years ago. I gave a talk recently to junior high school kids, science winners from around the country, 12 and 13-year-olds, and I told them you all would be senior citizens if it hadn't been for this progress. But this is going to go into high gear because of this grand transformation of health and medicine from having been a linear process, because it was not an information technology, to where it is now an information technology. I mentioned the Genome Project itself was a perfect exponential that you can see here. The amount of data where sequencing is doubling every year, the cost is coming down by half. That's continued since the end of the Genome Project. That first genome cost $1 billion. We're now down a few thousand dollars. But we're also understanding this software, being able to model it, simulate it, and most importantly, reprogram it. We have 23,000 little software programs inside us called genes. It's not a metaphor. They are sequences of data that control our lives. They're not written in C++. I think they're written in COBOL. Not every audience gets that joke. The junior high school kids were going, COBOL? COBOL? What's that? They're actually written in three-dimensional protein interactions. But they evolved in an era where things were very different. It was not in the interest for the human species for us to live very long. I mentioned life expectancy was 19. It was in the interest for some people to live to 25 or 30 so you could raise your kids. But then you're just using up the food and resources of the tribe. So evolution did not select for long life. So our immune system, for example, the T cells are intelligent little devices, natural ones, that detect pathogens, but they don't recognize cancer. It thinks, oh, that's me, and doesn't go after it. And there's a lot of other limitations which you ultimately can overcome. When we actually have little devices, that'll be the ultimate internet of everything, that travel through the bloodstream and augment our immune system. I'll come back to that. I mentioned 3D printing. We're actually somewhat in the hype cycle of that. I've written about the life cycle of technologies, and enthusiasts very often get ahead of themselves and think that things will take off instantly. So some of you look old enough to have been around during the internet craze of the 1990s. And if you remember, if you had the website address dog.com, you were a billionaire. Then around the year 2000, people realized, now wait a second, you can't really make money on these internet companies. And we had the internet crash that almost took down the world economy. But then it came back as the price performance really did come into place, and as we had a more mature understanding of what was required. Today we do have internet companies, you know, like my new employer and other big companies that are worth hundreds of billions of dollars that are internet companies. So this will be transformative as well, but we need submicron resolutions. We're not quite there. The resolutions are several microns. We'll be there around the year 2020. Then, for example, you'll be able to print out clothing. And there'll be a free open source market with very cool designs that cost nothing. You can download for free, print out for pennies per pound, and people go, great, there goes the fashion industry. But not so fast. I mean, think of other industries that have already transformed from physical products to digital products. Like, for example, music, movies, and books. If I wanted to send you a movie or a book or a music album just a few years ago, I'd send you a FedEx package. Now I can send you an email attachment. And indeed, there's an open source market where you can download for free, legally, millions of songs and documents and books and videos and movies. And you can have a very good time with these free media products. But people still spend money to download Harry Potter or see their favorite blockbuster movie or hear music from their favorite musical artist, and you have the coexistence of a free open source market, which is a great leveler, providing high quality products to everyone, and a proprietary market. And the revenues of these industries have gone up, not down, fueled by the ease with which those products can be promoted, distributed. We can make predictions about what products you'll like, and then you can acquire them instantly. And it's actually been a good thing, while it still provides high-quality free products to everyone. That's a model for the economy going forward. So these are some things that you can print out. We had Peter Dimanis, who you heard yesterday, and myself, and Larry Page founded Singularity University about 7 years ago. We had an opening party for our summer session, and every instrument in the band was printed out on a 3D printer. These are some other things you can print out today. But the real revolution will happen with submicron resolutions in the early 2020s. So I mentioned these nanorobots, nanobots for short. These will be nodes on the internet. This is the ultimate internet of everything. We'll have millions of them in our bloodstream and in our bodies and in our brains. I'll mention three interesting applications. So I mentioned one already, which is to augment the immune system. So you can have these little devices. They'll be programmed to go after diseases that get us later on in life and can download new software for new pathogens that emerge from the internet. So they'll be able to go after any infectious disease, also metabolic diseases. I mean, what do all these organs in our body do? Except for the heart and the brain, they all either put things in the bloodstream or take things out. So the lungs put in oxygen, take out carbon dioxide. The entire digestive tract puts in nutrients. The kidneys take out toxins and so on. And sometimes these levels are too high, too low. Pancreas isn't putting out enough insulin. There's too much glucose. So these devices can monitor the bloodstream and know what the ideal levels are of all these different substances and put things in, take things out, really augment or overcome the diseases of all of these organs. They'll deal with almost every disease. Another application is to go in the brain and provide the signals directly to your brain from your senses to provide full immersion, virtual reality or augmented reality from within the nervous system. We are about to enter an era of virtual reality. Facebook's $2 billion acquisition of Oculus Rift is just one harbinger of that. That revolution will not be from within the nervous system. That'll be devices on your eyes and your ears. I have patents on tactile devices, so you can actually hug someone or give them a kiss from hundreds of miles away. That's the revolution we're going to see over the next 5 to 10 years. But you go out 20 years to 2030s, these nanorobots will be able to provide the signals from within the nervous system. We actually already know quite a bit about how these signals are coded in the optic nerve and the auditory nerve and tactile nerves and so on. And so your brain would be receiving the signals that it would be receiving in the virtual or augmented environment. The most interesting application, though, is actually to put your neocortex on the cloud. Now, I mentioned that, you know, these devices we carry around are billions of times more powerful per dollar than the computers, you know, that I used when I was an undergraduate. But that's not actually the most interesting thing about it. If you need 10,000 computers, you can access that for a few seconds. In fact, as powerful as this is, almost all the things you do not take place inside the device. It goes out to the cloud. You know, if you do a search or a language translation, it goes out to the cloud. Just a search, you're accessing all of human knowledge, which resides on millions of computers. And so you're able to multiply the power of this computational device wirelessly in the cloud. We can't quite do that in our brains yet. I mean, I would argue this is actually an extension of my brain. My brain's directly in my fingers. The information from the device goes into my brain through my eyes and ears. It very much is a brain extender. But it's not connected directly to our brains yet. That's been the whole trend of computation. You know, as I mentioned, when I was an undergraduate, I had to take my bicycle across campus to get to the computer and take an elevator to the third floor. And, you know, now we carry them around. You know, they're on our wrists or all over our bodies. Some are already in our brains. If you're a Parkinson's patient, you have a computer connected into your brain. That's actually progressing exponentially. The first one was actually pretty big. It's like about this size, quite significant surgery, connected to one point, fairly simple signals. Now it actually has complex software. It's connected to many places in the brain. It's the size of a small pea. It can be inserted with minimally invasive surgery. And it does communicate outside and can be actually on the internet. And you can download new software to the neural implant inside, connected in your brain from outside the patient. That's today. Ultimately, that will be directly from the brain with non-invasive devices that go into the brain through the capillaries. But aside from the fact that I can utilize devices connected to the cloud, our brain is self-contained, and I'll describe how it works. I've been actually thinking about this for 50 years. We have 300 million modules in our neocortex. That's the part of the brain that does our thinking. And each of these modules can deal with a pattern. It can learn a pattern. It can remember the pattern. It can recognize a pattern when it encounters it in the world. It can implement that pattern, if we're, for example, acting in the world. And they're organized in hierarchies. So we have a hierarchy of these patterns. An idea in my mind is a hierarchy of symbols, where each symbol is a pattern consisting of other hierarchies. And something interesting happened 2 million years ago when we became humanoids. We developed a larger neocortex by having these large foreheads. If you look at other primates, they have a slanted brow. They don't have the frontal cortex. And the frontal cortex is well known for dealing with these higher level concepts, language and art and science and technology and conferences on subjects like Internet of Everything. No other species does that. That's conducted by the frontal cortex. But a very interesting discovery recently is that the frontal cortex is not qualitatively different than the rest of the neocortex. Some decades ago, there was a neuroscientist who studied the neocortex in all these different regions, because it was thought they must do different things. V1 in the back of the head, where the optic nerve spills into, does very simple features of visual images, like the fact that this is a straight line, and the frontal cortex does these high-level things. The fusiform gyrus up here recognizes faces. They must be very different and run different algorithms. So he did autopsies of the neocortex in all these different regions and found they all looked exactly the same, and he said neocortex is neocortex. And so what happened 2 million years ago is we got an additional quantity of neocortex. And what did we do with it? Well, we actually put it at the top of the hierarchy. We added more levels to that hierarchy. And as we go up the hierarchy, concepts become more abstract. The very bottom, which is actually the bulk of the neocortex, you know, I recognize, okay, that's a straight line and that's a curved line. At the very top, I recognize things like humor and musical melodies and things like that. So we put that additional neocortex at the top of the hierarchy, and that was the enabling factor for us to invent language, which was our first invention, and art and music and science and so on. Only humans with our frontal cortex, with that additional quantity of neocortex, does music, for example. Every culture we've ever discovered, every primitive tribe has music. Yet no other animals, including primates, have music. No other animal can keep a beat. Only humans do humor. These are unique features of humanity. That takes place at the top of the neocortex, and that's where we put this additional neocortex. Well, it was a one-time shot of additional neocortex, because it's a fixed enclosure. The circuitry was, you know, not evolving at any kind of rapid pace, but that was enough for us to make these inventions. We're going to do it again, except this time it won't be in a fixed enclosure. These nanobots will go non-invasively into the neocortex and basically connect it to the cloud. We have 300 million modules, but we don't need to put a connection for each of those, because the vast majority of them are at the lower levels of the neocortex. And as the neocortex goes higher in hierarchy, there are fewer and fewer modules at each higher level. So we might need only maybe 100,000, you know, to extend the top level of the neocortex into the cloud wirelessly, just the way we extend this device into the cloud wirelessly through wireless communication. And then we'll be able to add more neocortex, because if we create synthetic neocortex, we have to understand how it works, but I believe we do. That's what I articulate in this book. I gave a copy of this book to Larry Page in 2012, describes how I believe the neocortex works, describes the algorithm, which I describe as a modified hidden Markov model, and describe how it works and how we can use that as a sort of inspiration for the algorithms for artificial intelligence. And I asked him for an investment in a company I was going to start to develop these ideas, because that's the way I went about things as a serial entrepreneur. And he said, well, I'm interested in investing, but let me give you a better idea. Why don't you do it here at Google? We have all these millions of computers, and we have vast amount of data, and we have a lot of talent, and you can have your own group, and you can no one will tell you what to do. It'll be like running your own company. We'll pay the bills. That sounded pretty good to me. And so I started there a few months later. It was my first job, at least for a company I didn't start myself. And we are creating basically synthetic software models of how we believe the neocortex works and applying it to language. So I'll describe that briefly. I will point out that the information we're getting about the brain is expanding exponentially. As I mentioned, the spatial resolution of non-invasive scanning is doubling every year. We can now see individual interneuronal connections and see them firing in real time, seeing them connect to each other in real time. You can see your brain create your thoughts. We can see your thoughts create your brain, because that's key to how it works. So let me talk a little bit about that object at the top. That is the neocortex. You've seen images like that before. And neocortex means new rind. And it's a thin covering around the old brain, and that's where we do our thinking. And it emerged 200 million years ago with mammals. Only mammals have a neocortex. And these first mammals 200 million years ago were rodents, basically mice, and their neocortex then and now is the size of a postage stamp and as thin as a postage stamp, and it was a thin, flat covering around their walnut-sized brains. But it was capable of a new type of thinking. It was capable of invention and innovation. It could invent a new behavior. Animals without a neocortex, non-mammalian animals, can't do that. They have fixed behaviors. They can learn a new behavior, but not in the course of one lifetime. Maybe in the course of 10,000 lifetimes, they can use normal Darwinian evolution to evolve a new fixed behavior. And so a mouse is escaping a predator, but suddenly its path is blocked. That was unexpected. It will invent a new behavior to cope with that. Probably wouldn't work. But if it did work, it would remember it. And that new behavior could actually spread virally through the community. Another mouse watching this could say, wow, that was clever going around that rock. I'm going to remember to do that myself. And so these mammalian animals could invent new behaviors. Didn't help very much at first because the environment changed very slowly back then. It could take 40,000 years for it to be a new environmental change that would require a new behavior. These non-mammalian animals were very well adapted to the environment at that time. As the environment changed slowly, they could evolve new behaviors to cope with it. So that went along copacetically for 135 million years. But then something happened 65 million years ago. There was a sudden cataclysmic change to the environment very suddenly. If you dig down to a layer of rock reflecting 65 million years ago, the geologists will explain that that shows a catastrophic change in the environment that happened very quickly. And we see it all around the globe. And we call it today the Cretaceous extinction event because that's when the dinosaurs went extinct. That's when 75% of all the animal and plant species went extinct. And that's when mammals overtook their ecological niche because many of them could invent new behaviors to cope with this sudden change in the environment. So to anthropomorphize, biological evolution said to itself, this neocortex is pretty good stuff, and it began to grow it. And mammals got bigger, their brains got bigger at an even faster pace and took up a larger fraction of their bodies, and their neocortex got bigger even faster than that, and that's when it developed these curvatures, basically to extend its surface area. If you took the human neocortex and stretched it out, it's still a flat structure. It's one module thick. It's about the size of a table napkin and just as thin. But it had so many convolutions and curvatures now, it's actually 80% of the brain. And that's where the action is. That's where we do our thinking. We still have that old reptilian brain, but the neocortex is the great sublimator. So we get our basic instinctual drives from the old brain. So I might have a drive for conquest, but that'll be sublimated by the neocortex into giving a speech on the Internet of Everything or writing a book or designing a new algorithm. That is where the action is. And I mentioned there was another event 2 million years ago where we developed, basically obtained an additional quantity of neocortex with these large foreheads. It was a one-shot deal, and we're going to do it again. So I'll give you a quick rendition about how this works with a simple example. Cerebellum actually is interesting. That used to control our movement. That actually has the most neurons in the brain, but they're very small. Basically, remember scripts of action. So our signature is still actually controlled by the cerebellum because we're not using our intelligence as we do it. It's just kind of a pre-programmed sequence of movement. But most of our movement in the world now is actually taken over by this hierarchy of neocortical structures. So this is a block diagram of one of these 300 million modules. And they're organized in hierarchies, as I mentioned. So a simple example, so I'll have, let's say, hundreds of modules that all they've learned is to recognize the crossbar to a capital A. That's all they care about. They see a crossbar, they get very excited, and they say, crossbar! And they send a high probability on their output axon. It goes up to the next higher level. I mentioned each level is more abstract than the one below it. These are not physical levels because, as I mentioned, the neocortex is one module thick, but there's connections between the modules that creates these virtual levels. And each of these modules is 100 neurons. One interesting result that came out of the European brain reverse engineering project is that the neocortex is organized in these modules of 100 neurons that are repeated 300 million times across the entire neocortex. And within those 100 neurons, there's no plasticity. There's no rewiring. The topology and the interconnections within the 100 neurons is fixed for life. It's a connection between these modules of 100 neurons that are changing and growing and developing, creating these hierarchies. So it's really 100 neurons is the basic building block. It's a different architecture than, for example, deep neural nets that we use today, where one neuron is the basic building block. So anyway, that'll go up to the next higher level, which might say capital A. And then it goes up to the next higher level that might say the printed word apple. Information flows down also. If a module has seen every part of its pattern except one, let's say apple has seen A, P, P, L, but not E, it'll send a signal down to all the E recognizers saying, I think an E is likely, be on the outlook for it. And the E recognizers will lower their recognition threshold. So they see some sloppy thing, could be an E. Ordinarily, it really wouldn't think so, but we're expecting an E. So it says, yeah, good enough, and says, yes, we've seen E. And then Apple says, yes, we've seen Apple. And information flows up and down the hierarchy in this way. Go up another five levels. Now you're at a high enough part of the hierarchy that it stretches into the different senses, and it may have a module that sees a certain fabric, smells a certain perfume, hears a certain voice quality, and fires, oh, my wife has entered the room. Go up another 10 levels, and now you're at a very abstract level, and you might have modules that fire, that was funny, that was ironic, she's pretty, and you might think those are more sophisticated, and that's what we used to think, but it's actually the hierarchy below them that's more sophisticated and more complicated. There was a girl having brain surgery, and the surgeons wanted to talk to her because they wanted to get her reaction to different things. You can do that because there's no pain receptors in the brain. And whenever they stimulated these points shown in red, she would start to laugh. And at first they thought they were triggering some kind of laugh reflex, but they quickly realized that no, they were triggering the perception of humor. She just found everything hilarious whenever they stimulated these points. You guys are so funny, just standing there was a typical comment. And they weren't funny, not while doing brain surgery. But they had found some points, not all of them obviously, that detected humor. And again, we're going to add to these 300 million modules in the 2030s. I believe we already know pretty well how to simulate these neocortical regions. As the brain reverse engineering projects continue, we'll get more and more details about that. We can create simulated neocortex in the cloud. That's what I'm actually working at Google, to apply that to language. And then we can actually add again to the higher levels of the neocortex. And then we'll be a hybrid of biological and non-biological thinking. I mean, I would argue we are already there in a sense, and that these are brain extenders, but we'll very literally extend the actual architecture we have. That'll be the ultimate sort of internet of everything, that we'll be having these millions of devices inside our bodies and brains, all connected wirelessly to each other. Keep in mind that the non-biological part of our thinking then will be subject to the law of accelerating returns. It'll be in the cloud. The cloud is pure information technology. It is growing exponentially in capability. Our biological thinking is fixed. We are, for example, applying this to language. To take an example from another company, IBM's Watson won the Jeopardy contest. Now, people very often dismiss artificial intelligence, saying, yeah, it can do things beyond humans, but in very narrow areas like playing chess. Well, Jeopardy is not so narrow. I think that was a really key threshold in the history of artificial intelligence, because unlike chess, which really is just kind of a logic combinatorial game, language encompasses all of our intelligence. That was Alan Turing's insight when he based the Turing test on language. And the queries in Jeopardy are not so simple. They have all the ambiguities and subtleties of language. For example, Watson got this query correct in the rhyme category: a long, tiresome speech delivered by a frothy pie topping. And Watson quickly said, what is a meringue harangue? And Jennings and Rutter, the best two Jeopardy players in the world, didn't get that. As you can see, Watson got a higher score than the two of them combined on this game that involves kind of all of human knowledge at some level and subtle interactions with language. And what's not widely appreciated is that Watson got his knowledge not by being hand-coded by the engineers with all of this information, but by actually reading Wikipedia and several other encyclopedias, 200 million pages of natural language documents. It actually doesn't read them as well as you or I. It might read one of those documents and conclude, there's a 56% chance that Barack Obama is president of the United States. You could read that page, and if you didn't happen to know that ahead of time, conclude there's a 98% chance that he's president. So you did a much better job than Watson at reading that page. So why is it that Watson's so much better at this broad knowledge and language game? Well, it makes up for its relatively weak reading by reading more pages. It read 200 million pages. And personally, I get stuck at about 100 million pages. And it has a good Bayesian reasoning system. It can combine all its inferences. It's probably read 100,000 pages pertaining to whether Obama's president. So it combines all these probabilities and concludes it's a 99.9% chance that he's president. And it can do all of that with all of these different inferences in the 3-second Jeopardy time frame. That's the threshold we're on. We want to bring more natural language understanding, for example, to Google, so that it's already taken some steps. As you know, you can now ask Google and other search engines questions in natural language, and the sophistication of those questions is gradually getting broader. We'd like you to actually be able to converse in natural language, have it get to know you, and be able to anticipate your questions even before you ask them. That's the direction we're headed in. And I'll just show you one last slide, which is, this is the progress we've made in health and medicine, and that's before it became an information technology. That was from the sort of hit-or-miss approach we've been using. We're going to be reprogramming our biology. That's, we call it the second bridge. The third bridge is nanotechnology, these nanorobots, which will be communicating with each other. Again, another sort of ultimate application of Internet of Everything, keeping us healthy. We already have clinical applications coming into existence. For example, we can now fix a broken heart, not yet from romance. That'll take some more advances in virtual reality. But from a heart attack, 50% of all heart attack survivors have a damaged heart. It's called low ejection fraction. You can fix that now by reprogramming stem cells. This is going to go into high gear very soon. These technologies are already 1,000 times more powerful than they were when the general project was completed. That's the implication of doubling in power every year. They'll be another 1,000 times more powerful in 10 years, a million times more powerful than they are today in 20 years. Somewhere between 10 and 15 years from now, we'll be adding more than a year every year, not just to infant life expectancy, but to your remaining life expectancy. Now, life expectancy is a statistical phenomena. You could still be hit by the proverbial bus tomorrow. We're working on that, too, with self-driving cars. But, you know, within 15 years, you'll go forward a year, your life expectancy will move on away from you. So if you can hang in there, we may get to see the remarkable century ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ray. So we have a few questions that were submitted that I thought we might ask. So the first one that's here is, presumably every company that sells physical products can benefit in some way by having those products connected. Can you imagine a day where 100% of companies that sell physical products sell connected products?
Well, we're very close to that. I mean, I showed these graphs, and as I mentioned, you know, each of these little points, they don't look very interesting on the graph, but they represent revolutions like that. And we're expanding exponentially the number of points that are connected wirelessly through this kind of intelligent communication. So we're very close to an era now where people are communicating, you know, with their kitchen appliances and their security systems and their kids and other people. And so more and more devices are becoming connected. That's going to become very dense. So I gave some perhaps extreme examples, but they're not that far off, where we have thousands and ultimately millions of, you know, wireless points of communication inside our bodies communicating with each other. But definitely that's the direction we're headed in.
Okay. So if you assume that when every product is connected, what will be next? What's the next big wave of connectivity after the IoT, or is it just a deeper version of the IoT?
I think the most interesting thing is, you know, putting them inside our bodies and brains. Our bodies are very dynamic systems where everything's dependent on everything else. We have examples of that. There are devices going inside the body that monitor things like glucose and connect to some other device that's putting out insulin inside the body and things like that. We have actually fairly intricate multi-object communication for neural implants for things like epilepsy and Parkinson's is well established. And that's going to become very fine-grained. But, you know, particularly when we can put them in the bloodstream and have all these devices communicating with each other. The immune system, our natural biological immune system, has some communication between these devices. It's not universal. Basically, these T cells can communicate with other ones in their local environment using chemical signals. But ultimately, we can put them in there and have them all communicate with each other and develop much more effective strategies against pathogens. Mm-hmm.
And so how do you think the IoT will pave the way for entirely new types of companies, the way that the Internet gave birth to Amazon and mobile technologies gave birth to companies like Uber?
Well, I think there are exciting new applications from having everything connected. And this will be worked out by the market. You know, parents want to keep track of their kids. Mm-hmm. The kids like to actually have all their toys communicating with each other. You know, we want to control things even if we're not at home in our kitchens and our appliances and our homes. And so that's happening now. And as the communication gets more and more fine-grained, more and more applications like that will open up.
So given all of the predictions that you shared in your presentation, are there any predictions about the IoT that you've heard that you think are not going to come to fruition?
Yeah, no.
Excellent. We're all in good shape. That's fantastic.
I mean, usually, I make predictions that people think are pretty fantastic. When they happen, it's like, oh, of course, and it's always been that way. I mean, think of the world today that we have these devices and we can ask intelligent questions. I mean, you see people at tables in restaurants, and settle an argument. They, you know, ask a question in natural language and assume that that was always the case. But that didn't happen even a year ago. We very quickly forget what things are like. And in fact, the future is more fantastic than what we can imagine because we have all of you and millions of others who come up with creative ideas we haven't thought of yet to apply all these technologies.
So on that point, then, if we have the room full of entrepreneurs and business leaders, what advice would you give the folks that are in here around how to think more exponentially versus linearly?
Well, that's why I came up with this technique, really, was to time my own technology projects, because I had a lot of ideas about the future, and so this way I could decide when to start different things. I could also then invent with the technologies of the future, 10 years, 20 years from now. Couldn't build those yet, but I could write about them, and that's the sort of source of the ideas in my books. But I do counsel, you know, companies, small and big, like Google. And my primary message is you can tell exactly where these technologies will be 3 years from now, 5 years from now. It's actually moving fast enough now that, you know, even 2 years from now are quite daunting changes. I was running an ebook company before I came to Google, and we wrote down all the technologies that affected our business, display resolution, mobile computing speeds, and so on, and looked at it. And so what are the scenarios for 1 year out, 2 years out? So even 2 years out, I'm saying, whoa, mobile computing is going to be that different? That kind of blew my mind. Now, of course, we assume it's always the case. But, you know, early in the smartphone era, they seemed kind of clunky devices, and that they would take over was not at all clear. So even though I've been doing this for 30 years, I still have a linear intuition. You really need to go through the discipline and look at your technology and business plans. Even 12, 18, 24, 36 months from now, things are going to be very different. Look at the price, performance, and capacity of these, all the different technologies that affect your business, and make sure your plans are consistent with where we will be. And it's not intuitive. I mean, I do some early stage investing. I get all these business plans, and people assume, yeah, devices will be a little smaller, a little faster. Basically, it's going to be like today. And people's imagination about even the fairly near-term future fails them unless you go through this discipline.
So I would like to thank you for the time that you spent with us today, and I really appreciate everything that you shared with us. And so a round of applause for you.